Okay, good afternoon. I want to thank Richard Wright and also Josep Lluís Prades, who's not here at the moment, for their kind availability to changes, to the all the changes that we need to have in order to reorganize the agenda of this meeting. So now, not tomorrow, we have the presentation of Richard Wright from the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago, the Kennedy College of Law, about legal proof, modernism, and statistical evidence. Thank you so much for your time for 40 minutes.
Thank you, and thank you, Jordy, for inviting me to attend this, even though I don't speak Spanish, and for making it possible for me to come. Susan mentioned a while ago, I've been interested in the issue of proof, and especially the attempts by scholars, especially in the U.S., to develop mathematical models of proof since at least 1988, when I wrote kind of probably what, let's see here, what is probably still my most thorough discussion of the issue of attempts to prove, use probability to prove specific causation, which I criticized in a fairly long part of this already long article. It's in the 73 California Law Review. What the pages? It starts at 1001, but it's pages 1042 to 77 in 1988. And has a discussion of a lot of the problems with the mathematical probability approach from various perspectives. So if you wanted a more thorough discussion of some of the issues I'll talk about, you might want to take a look at that article. But today I want to celebrate Susan's work, because she has been doing work much sounder philosophically than mine, and in a series of fairly recent papers has really that are many of which are included in her book, Evidence Matters, that was published in 2014. She quite clearly describes and incisively critiques the mathematical models of proof that are being used. And as she explains, much of the confusion is due to a confusion of what the meaning of our standards of proof are, especially in the common law. The standards of proof that we use. For example, in the common law, we have a clear distinction, unlike most civil law jurisdictions, between criminal law and civil law standards of proof. We have a clear beyond a reasonable doubt standard for criminal law, whereas in civil law, generally, it is a lower, what's called in the U.S. the preponderance of the evidence standard, and what's called in England the balance of probability, in the English Commonwealth, the balance of probability standard. We have also an in-between standard, clear and convincing, right? Now, it's pretty clear for the beyond a reasonable doubt and the clear and convincing, these are belief standards, right? These are talking about some required degree of belief in the truth of the proposition there, the fact being asserted. But because of the preponderance of the evidence standard, which also is kind of often stated as a greater weight of the evidence standard, that has become in recent years often interpreted as meaning more likely than not, and more likely than not surprisingly, along with the balance of probability standard in England, has been open to an interpretation of, well, more likely than not in a mathematical probability standard. And that, of course, is also makes it possible to say, all we're really talking about is statistical probability, right? So that has led to successful efforts in some cases in the, by the courts, and by more efforts by academics to try and say that all that's really required in civil cases is a mere proof statistically, you know, that some particular fact happened. Now, in the civil law, I think that generally has not been the case. In the civil law, it's still generally agreed that this is a belief standard. Unfortunately, there's been very little written until very recently, that I'm aware of anyway, about the standards of proof in civil law. In fact, when I first gave my talk a number of years ago in Vienna on when I started studying the difference between civil law and common law, and was surprised to learn that there was no elaboration of standards, and that often there was no distinction between criminal and civil, apparently, and that in both civil as well as criminal, it was often thought to be a virtual certainty, kind of like the reasonable beyond a reasonable doubt standard, that it was just as high for civil as criminal, it, you know, led to more of my investigations. As I said, I think it's the case, I'm willing to be corrected, that really until very recently, and in part, I think because of the paper I gave in Vienna, that only recently has there been much attention paid in civil law jurisdictions to the standards of proof, in terms of what they are, you know, in criminal law or civil law. Often it's stated merely, for example, in France, is there, the judge has to have an in-team conviction, the judge has to be convinced. Or in Germany, the judge has to be convinced, right? In Germany, it's said that a degree of conviction is required that silences doubt for all practical purposes without completely eliminating them. But, you know, there's no nothing elaborated beyond that and no distinction generally between criminal and civil. There is, I just ran across, in fact, it was shown to me yesterday by Professor Martin Casals here, there's a book published just last year, which looks to be very useful, about standard of proof in Europe, published just last year, that was edited by Lubos Tichy from Czechoslovakia, I think. I know it is available on Amazon, is the only place I found it. I just ordered it today for myself and started to look at some of the articles, but it looks to be pretty useful. And it also confirms some of the things that that both Susan and I have been saying, but what we've learned from studying the more extensive literature in cases in common law jurisdictions. So we have had developed, you know, in the last 20 or 30 years, more and more of this attempts to develop mathematical models of proof and use statistical evidence. Well, the question is, when is, again, statistical evidence is good in a lot of situations. If you want to try and predict what will happen, you're going to use statistical evidence, you're going to use frequencies. If you want to bet on what's already happened, you know, but you don't know actually what did happen, you're going to use statistical frequencies, right? But the issue, and so they're useful for that, but even there, you know, as Susan has argued very convincingly, even there, and as generally agreed, they aren't sufficient. They aren't even necessary even to prove what we call general causation, right? General causation is the capacity of something to cause something else. It kind of relates to basically trying to establish causal laws, causal generalizations, laws of nature, right? That this is actually how things work in general, in the abstract. That's what we call general causation. On the other hand, we sometimes have to try and prove specific causation. You know, what actually happened in this case? Well, I believe from the very beginning that although statistics are useful, but they're not sufficient or necessary for proving general causation, that they're, you know, I mean, they're useful, but they're not necessary or sufficient, that they are not relevant beyond that at all, beyond the issue of proving general causation, which has become more of an issue recently in tort law, right? The old cases were all, you know, crash, ban, slash, hit sort of cases where it's pretty obvious this can cause this. But now we have all these toxic cases and delay in diagnosis and medical cases and so on, where, you know, it's much more complicated scientifically and proof-wise. I think what's happened is that we have, and Susan has gone into this in terms of the toxic tort cases, especially a very revealing development of the history of how we came to start using the statistical evidence standard in toxic tort cases. I think it started there because it's one of the two major areas in which It really is impossible to prove specific causation, right? All you really have, unless it's a signature disease, this always and only this causes this, right? If it's that case, this is the only thing that causes this and they were exposed to it, then of course you've got proof, but you didn't need statistics to prove that, right? Except it's 100%. But otherwise, you know, what you have is a situation where they were exposed, you know, 70% of the time it leads to this injury or disease, 30% of the time it doesn't. Another area which is very similar is medical malpractice. You know, delay of diagnosis or failure to diagnose, right? And this has kind of led to the development of these lost chance cases in medical, right? I mean, you can kind of say, well, the delay in diagnosis, the failure to diagnose, you know, increased the risk of this disease or of death generally, right, by 20% or 30%, right? But you can't really say in this case that it really did make a difference. You can't use a but-for sort of test, sine qua non, to say it really made a difference, right? All you can kind of say is, well, you know, 70% of the time it makes a difference, it contributed, 30% of the time it doesn't. In this case, how do we know? And doctors will tell you, we can't know for sure, right? And they get a little bit upset when they're kind of told by lawyers, you can go into court and say, based on the legal standard, you know, which is now thought to be maybe more likely than not 50%+, that's enough. But if a good defense attorney comes up and kind of says, but can you really say it caused it in this case? They have to say no. And they're going to feel embarrassed and mad the lawyers made them say, yeah, that's enough, because it isn't enough, right? So, as I say, Susan worked on this, you know, and developed this quite clearly in a number of articles, which are collected in the Evidence Matters book, and since, you know, further developed it, talking mainly about the idea in toxic tort cases that you can prove specific proof of causation if you can show that the risk was more than doubled, right? Because if you have more than a doubling of the risk, that means more likely than not, in this case, it was due to this exposure, right? Because a little more than half of the incidents, if it more than doubles the risk, a little more than half of the incidents are due to this exposure. That's the, you know, the excess is because of that. You then can say, more likely than not, it was due to this. The probability, 51%, 52% was due to this. But that obviously can't be enough to prove that it actually caused it in this case. But the courts have kind of been able to kind of say, well, it's enough because even though it seems, you know, not intuitive, in fact, wrong, because of our standard of proof, right? Because we have this preponderance of the evidence, which means balance of probability, which means a likely, more likely than not, more probable than not, or even in England, a balance of probability test, right? That kind of, well, probability is just statistics, right? It's just mathematical probability, it's statistics. Again, you know, well, the question then becomes, well, how did these standards develop and did they really mean that? Were they meant to mean that, right? I mean, literally, they mean that, right? But were they really meant to mean that? Well, it depends upon how you interpret the word probability, right? And nowadays, when we think of probability, I think we almost automatically turn to mathematical statistics, right? But if you look at the history of the development and even current use, but I'll talk about the history first, I guess I'm not doing a very good job of bringing this down, am I? And once again, there we go. I'm sorry. That's the wrong place. I'll try and keep up here. That the employment of the statistical probability standard, you know, in these cases, and you know, and you can see why the court, you know, maybe kind of reached to use it in these cases, because otherwise there's going to be not going to be any liability, right? We're going to have lots of people being injured by exposure to this, but you can never prove, even if it's 90% of the cases are due to this, if you're required to prove in this case this is really what caused it, you can't. All you can do is say 90% probability, right? Well, I think that, you know, courts and others kind of thought, well, that really isn't, you know, doesn't seem to be fair that none of these people can recover as a matter of justice or deterrence, right? That there should be some liability, right? And of course, typically in the law, liability is full. It's not proportional, it's full, You know, it took a long time for courts to decide in the U.S. that that we're going to have comparative responsibility, because they said there's really no way to measure fault, for example. And they also had this idea of everything has to be either all or nothing. It seemed to be they had a hard time grasping the idea of proportional recovery. So in these sort of cases, you know, they say, well, you know, there's no recovery, or we need to kind of say somehow that this is sufficient proof. Well, we can use this balance of probability standard, we can use this preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not, that's the legal standard, it's established, right? Now, so when has this been done? It's been done pretty much, I think, primarily, and not by all courts, but primarily and almost only in these toxic tort cases, these medical malpractice cases, in one other area where I think it has a fairly long history of misinterpretation, but maybe not quite as much, is in the area of what we call res ipsa loquitur in the common law. You know, that, you know, it's a presumption, you know, that this ordinarily, it was stated originally by the English courts as this would not happen, this could not happen in the absence of negligence, right? You know, and it was kind of phrased in ordinary experience, this would not happen in the absence of negligence. Well, then it turns out it happens. Well, if it turns out, you know, logically, if this would not happen in the absence of negligence, and it happened, then there must have been negligence that caused it. So res ipsa loquitur is used to prove not only causation, but also negligence, right? So the original phrasing, the original case was a barrel fell out of the top of a building and fell on somebody, because this wouldn't happen unless somebody was negligent. And if you can prove that that it had to be one of the defendant's employees, it must have been them, right? But then that word ordinarily in there, you know, kind of all of a sudden the shift that kind of came toward, you know, instead of kind of saying in ordinary experience this would not happen, it kind of became to change, say, ordinarily this would not happen. Well, that kind of sounds more like a probability thing, right? Most of the time, this would not happen. And that's led to a lot of courts in the U.S. and the third and the restatements to say, well, all you have to prove to establish, you know, negligence and causation through res ipsa loquitur is that more than half the time this is due to negligence, right? Then you've got it made, which again seems wrong, right? Not only are you kind of proving causation, you're proving negligence, right? More than half the time when this sort of thing is due to negligence by the driver, in this case, we know who the driver was, there must have been negligence that caused it, which seems particularly problematic. So those are the three areas I'm aware of where we've kind of had this shift into this probability sort of analysis, because we have, you know, made much easier in the common law, because we have these standards of proof that seem to use probability language, right? Balance of probability, more likely than not. But if you go into the history of these, and I quote the, and as Susan has argued, it really kind of fails to recognize that historically, and even still some today, probability had an ambiguous dual meaning. One of which referred to mathematical probability, but in the context of courts and judicial proof, it referred to degrees of belief, right? Probability referred to degrees of belief. And in fact, you know, it's not in the paper here, but one of the interesting things that I found from the very first paper in this book I told you about that Professor Martin Casal showed to me yesterday goes into the history in Europe and in Czechoslovakia especially, but also in Europe, quite clearly kind of showing that the main debate, in fact, the only real debate about standards of proof in Europe until very recently, was a debate between, you know, whether there should be a more subjective in-team conviction sort of standard, a free the judge is free to make a decision, right? Or a bound standard. Somehow the judge's determination is somehow bound by some rule, you know, some practice, whatever. So there was this debate mainly between those who advocated for the free determination of the judge, right? And those who said, no, it should be a bound determination. It can't be purely subjective by this particular judge. It has to be more objective, some sort of bound decision. But you look at the language that's kind of quoted in there, it's not in my paper. I was thought maybe if I did it tomorrow, I'd have time to put it in, but I'm doing it today, so I don't. But you kind of have the quotations that very clearly they're talking about probability, using probability or probable in the sense of explicitly a degree of belief, right? And they were kind of said, well, it doesn't have to be absolutely certain. It only kind of has to be some sort of probability of, you know, sort of thing. And by probability, they didn't mean just statistically. They meant that it refers to, you know, kind of a level of belief, right? And the California Evidence Code says all of our standards are all refer to a degree of belief, and they are beyond a reasonable doubt, clear and convincing, and preponderance of the evidence. They really are degrees of belief, right? So historically, you had this notion, this concept of probability as referring to, you know, not absolute certainty, but lower levels of belief, right? All the way from a bare minimal belief that this happened into clear and convincing to beyond a reasonable doubt, absolutely certain, right? But probability was referred to in terms of various levels of belief. And what I do have in my paper is a quote from John Locke's An Essay Concerning Human Understanding, in which if you read the whole thing, he's clearly kind of going back and forth between, you know, preponderance of the evidence, probability, belief, but he's using these as all meaning the same thing, right? They all mean the same thing. That in the end, what we call belief, conjecture, guess, doubt, warning, distrust, disbelief, they're all belief terms, right? And that's kind of what, you know, the idea was of what we're trying to use in these cases. Now, I think, as Susan has also said, that modern jury instructions in the U.S. continue to focus on required degrees of belief, even though they talk about, you know, more likely than not or more probable than not, they almost always say a couple of things, right? One is more likely than not true, right? More probable than not true, and based on the evidence, right? You got to consider all the evidence, which is, you know, what Susan's been arguing for a long time. And for example, at least I'm not sure if this is the exact form of these jury instructions right now, but two of the probably most used jury instructions in the U.S. still have that kind of combination of belief and probability. Established by a preponderance of the evidence means evidence which as a whole shows that the fact ought to be proved as more probable than not. In other words, a preponderance of the evidence means such evidence as when considered and compared with the evidence opposed to it has more convincing force, right? More convincing force, and produces in your minds belief that what is thought to be proved is more likely true than not true. And the other one, to establish a fact by a preponderance of the evidence means to prove that the fact is more likely true than not true. A preponderance of the evidence means the greater weight of the evidence. It refers to the quality and persuasiveness of the evidence, not to the number of witnesses or documents. So long as you find that the scales tip however slightly in favor of the party with the burden of proof, that what the party claims is more likely true than not true, then that element will have been proved by a preponderance of the evidence. I mean, these are clearly referring to belief, conviction, right? And the second one, I think, especially kind of tells us, okay, you know, how should we interpret this idea of a preponderance of the evidence and how it's used in the common law? It means a bare minimal belief, right? All you have to do, no matter having substantial doubt, all you have to do as a form to belief, no matter how, you know, soft that belief is, you've gone beyond kind of a mere statistical prediction into saying, I believe, I have substantial doubts, but I believe this is what happened, right? So that's the lowest level, the minimum level threshold of belief. And you can move up to clear and convincing, you can move up to virtual certainty, you can move up to beyond a reasonable doubt, but, you know, you have to have at least this minimal belief, right? Not just a statistic to back this up. Now, Susan has also argued, however, and she was the one that kind of first really made it kind of clear to me, that the standard is not and should not be simply a belief function, right? It kind of goes back to the debate in the civil law between the free determination of the judge and the bound determination of the judge. It can't, it should not just be the belief of this particular judge, right? No matter how, you know, poorly based, right? So it has to be kind of based on all the evidence in the case, and it has to be kind of one which it really is warranted by the evidence in the case, as Susan argues. And the objective nature of the legally required belief is kind of clear by the fact that judges are allowed and required to take the issue away from the jury, the factual issue away from the jury in the U.S., if no reasonable mind could reach the conclusion. You know, if this is an issue upon which finding for the plaintiff on this fact no reasonable person could do, that issue is taken away from the jury, right? So it isn't just purely a subjective belief of the jury members or whoever. It's bound, right, by this criterion. It has to be one which is reasonable and rational based on the evidence, you know. And you may be able to argue back and forth about, you know, do you believe it or not, but it has to be one which a reasonable person could say, I find that this is true, right? That this is the actual facts in the case. So it is, you know, it is a one that has to be warranted, as Susan has argued for a long time, by the evidence in the case. All right, well then, that brings us to kind of, I think, you know, Susan's really kind of major contribution, which is her found heritist theory. Somebody saw the title of my article in the U.S. yesterday and said, I'd never seen that term before. but you know, I think it's the idea, of course, it's sort of a combination of, you know, the two bipolar opposite, you know, positions of foundationalism and coherentism, right? Coherence. The foundationalism kind of says, you know, basically everything is kind of based on certain rules and principles and it always follows in this sort of linear, sort of logical way, whereas coherentism kind of says, well, no, we kind of just try and make everything coherent and consistent in the evidence, right? And Susan kind of says, well, no, it's a combination of those two, right? That we have to have kind of real evidence like foundationalism insists upon. There has to be kind of some idea of the reality of the evidence underneath this, the real world underneath it, right? Can't just be coherent fantasy, has to be real evidence underneath it. But on the other hand, you know, we don't require a sort of logically constructed proof based on certain fundamental, you know, principles. Instead, we require that this be kind of coherent, you know, in terms of putting all the different evidence pieces together in the sort of, I think, the useful crossword way that she mentions, you know, that every piece of evidence kind of has to be kind of coherent in and tied with other pieces of evidence, and that you sometimes have to kind of dig pretty deeply in terms of, well, kind of, but also the evidence, which kind of says that the you know, I think that you're all pretty familiar with this, is that the sort of three basic things she always talks about is, depends on a consideration, the warrant for a particular belief is a matter of degree and depends on consideration of how supportive the evidence is of the belief, right? And that's kind of sort of in terms of how well it fits in, you know, with, you know, this particular belief, how well it fits in with all the evidence that we kind of have, you know, available here, and how that all ties together. How secure the background beliefs are, you know, in a crossword puzzle, you know, how good is the evidence for each word in the crossword, but also how well do they all tie together? And then, you know, how much of the relevant evidence has been considered? You should kind of include as much of the relevant evidence as you can, right? So you, all those factors combine to kind of provide sufficient warrant to a sufficient degree, depending upon what the standard of proof is, that this really is what, you know, you're warranted in kind of saying, I believe this is what really happened, right? Now, okay, I've already kind of gone through the jury instructions, I think. Now, to go at it another way, you know, in terms of, you know, should we interpret these standards of proof as mere probability standards, especially statistical proof standards? Is, you know, again, as Susan has argued very clearly and consistently, are they really, is treating them as mere mathematical statistical probabilities, is that consistent with the idea of, you know, that we have to have a certain sort of belief? Or, you know, if you want to try and have them serve that sort of function in terms of proof, will they make sense in terms of trying to apply the theorems, the axioms of probability theory to proof in a case? And it's been kind of, you know, made very clear, you know, including Jonathan Cohen was one of the first that raised the number of paradoxes. If you try and treat proof as a matter of mathematical probability, and you try and follow the mathematical probability theorems, which you have to if that's how you look at it, a whole host of paradoxes arise, right? And the two that Susan has talked about, I think most, are the, and these are quotes from her book, Evidence Matters, one is the negation paradox, or the negation axiom, you know, which clearly we don't apply to our decisions about what happened in a particular case, right? The mathematical probability of P and not P, right, of the combination of two events, both occurring at the same time, must add up to one. And mathematically, the probability it happened, you know, and the probability it didn't happen, have to equal one, right? To give a probability to one, to get the probability of the other, you subtract that from one, right? If they're independent, right? If they're independent things that are happening rather than dependent upon each other. But the axiom for combining these independent probabilities is you multiply them together, right? Well, we clearly don't do that, can't do that, don't want to do that in terms of proof in the law. Because if you multiply probabilities together, they just keep getting lower and lower, right? Even if one of them was a virtual certainty, you multiply the next one 0.0 times 0.9, you got a 0.9. If you kind of say, well, the standard of proof we think mathematically is, as they argue, just barely over 50%, right? 51%. Then if you multiply 0.5 times 0.5 together, you get only 0.25, right? Well, they say you have to kind of combine these different elements together using this multiplication function. But if you do that, you can never prove anything. I mean, all the defense has to do is keep adding in more and more elements you have to prove, and it'll get lower and lower and lower. What do we do in the law? What we do in the law is we kind of require that the standard of proof be met for each required element. We don't combine them together. We kind of say, prove by a preponderance the evidence that this happened, you know, that there was negligence, by a preponderance the evidence that there was causation, that there was an injury, right, that this is all linked together through causation. And we kind of just apply it to each one separately. So doing that, there's no problem. But if you interpret these, the proof requirement as a statistical proof requirement, you have to multiply these together. We don't do that. The conjunction paradox, or the conjunction axiom, that was the conjunction one. The negation, I mentioned both of them. One's the negation, one's the conjunction, right? So that's very problematic in terms of the way we actually prove cases. You know, we prove cases, you know, focusing on each element rather than kind of saying you have to calculate the probability of each one being true and then multiply all those together, in which case you never could prove anything. Another paradox is Jonathan Cohen's famous gatecrasher, you know, hypothetical. You assume that, you know, 1,000 people go to a football game, right? And that 499 of them paid their tickets, for their tickets, 501 didn't, right? 501 gatecrashers, right? And once the tickets are handed in, they're destroyed, they aren't kept. There's no pictures taken of who handed in a ticket and who was a gatecrasher. Well, if you follow the mathematical probabilist idea of what the standard of proof is, 50%+, you can prove that everybody was a gatecrasher, right? The probability for any one person, given that more than half of them were gatecrashers, the probability for any one person is that they're a gatecrasher, right? Now, again, that not only kind of seems odd to kind of say we have no specific proof you were a gatecrasher, but it's even odder and clearly wrong to say we can prove every one of them was a gatecrasher when we know only 501 of them were, right? So it just isn't going, it's not going to be really kind of work. Now, the mathematical probabilists agree that this really kind of doesn't make any sense. They try various methods to try and kind of save their theories in the new evidence scholarship. One is they often try to argue, well, there's some missing evidence, right? And if you use Bayes' theorem to kind of build in this missing evidence, it'll bring it down below 50%. But two problems, often there isn't any missing evidence. This is all the evidence there is. There is no evidence that wasn't brought in that should have been brought in. This is all we've got. And the second is that even if you use Bayes' theorem, you know, in attempt to do this, it often won't bring it down to, you know, what you want. You know, for example, assume that there's 999 of the 1,000 were gate crashers, right? Only one person paid for the ticket. But the ticket seller says, I know who paid for that ticket, right? And, you know, and if you want me to state a level of confidence, I'll state 98%, right? By the way, when judges and jurors are asked in surveys to interpret, you know, these standards of proof in probability terms, a lot of them refuse to do it, judges and juries. And those that do it often put higher percentages, much, much higher than 50%, 70 or 80% or even higher, right? I mean, they just don't think about it this way, right? But if you kind of tried to use Bayes' theorem in that particular case I just talked about, you know, all but one were gate crashers, but the ticket taker says, you know, I'm virtually certain, you know, this is the person, you know, who paid for the ticket, 98% confident. If you kind of use that information of the ticket seller to try and modify the 99%, 99.9% down, it still remains 95% probability this person was a gate crasher. So you've got the specific evidence of the person who took the ticket, right? They were not the gate crasher, they paid for their ticket. If you follow the mathematical probabilist approach, it's still a 95% chance that he didn't pay. And that's probably enough, from their view, for criminal liability, not just civil liability. All right, so Susan and I agree on almost everything. And she's written about it a lot better than I have in most cases. But I think we disagree on one issue. And that's, I believe that although statistical evidence is useful for proving general causation, you know, but not necessary or sufficient, that it is not relevant at all for specific causation, right? Once you've used it to establish that this is capable of proving something else, once you've kind of said 70% of the time this produces this, it does not give us any aid at all in saying, you know, all right, in this case, did it cause it or not? And a doctor will refuse to tell you. They'll say, I can't tell you that, right? But, you know, does it give us any aid in doing that? Susan says that, well, you know, and I understand as part of her found here in his theory, it's one more bit of evidence, right? Just lump it in with the rest. Maybe it doesn't count for very much, but lump it in. I don't think it's relevant at all, right? It tells us nothing about, say we have 70%, it gives us nothing to be able to kind of, you know, decide, is this one of the 70% cases or is it one of the 30%? It just doesn't tell us that, right? I mean, if you had, you know, some sort of horse race going on, right, and this horse wins 70% of their races, or some exposure to some, you know, toxic substance 70% of the time produces injury, right? You'd be willing to bet on that horse winning before the race. You'd be willing to bet that he won after the race if the result wasn't known yet. But you're not going to pay on that bet until you have specific evidence which horse won the race, right? Well, same thing, you shouldn't be willing to pay in the toxic tort case unless you have some specific evidence. The problem is we can't get it, right? It's just impossible, right? So I think that really in those sort of cases, it really isn't relevant at all. Susan kind of says it's just one more piece of evidence to add in. At one point she said if it's high enough, maybe it's good enough by itself, but I don't think she believes it's good enough by itself really. She said you always have to kind of have, you know, the kind of the concrete evidence along with that to kind of provide a real true belief in what happened. Let me finish by saying, like Susan, I don't disbelieve in mathematical probability theorems. I don't disbelieve in Bayes' theorem. They're all very valid. I don't disbelieve in the use of statistical evidence ever in the law. Again, it's useful, not necessary or sufficient, for proving general causation. It's also useful, I think, in these sort of cases where it's impossible to prove specific causation, right? And, but not by kind of saying, we're doing what we can't do. We can take this statistic to prove specific causation, but by saying, we should instead adopt the second best solution, right? We should base we should base liability on a probability of causation. We should admit we can't prove causation, but we can prove through the statistics a probability of causation. And maybe as a matter of justice and fairness, we should award proportional liability based on a probability of causation. Now, the first cases that kind of came up with these uncertainty things, like the multiple hunter cases, three hunters fire in the direction of somebody, only one hits them, the courts all recognize we can't say which one did it, right? But they said we should impose liability on all of them, solidary liability, and let them fight it out among themselves as a matter of fairness. Well, looking back on it, maybe we should have instead said, let's impose proportional liability on each. But the idea of proportional liability didn't come up until these toxic tort cases, when the court said, well, we've got these standards of proof, we can do that. But again, they impose full liability, right, rather than proportional. It first came up in the DES cases, in the medical malpractice cases, when the percentage of probability is less than 50%, right? So I think that if you in these particular areas where it's really impossible to prove specific causation, these specific areas, of course, there's the danger if you use it here, where do you stop? That's an argument, right? But in these cases, it might well be, in the medical misdiagnosis cases, in the toxic tort cases, we should say, we should admit we can't prove specific causation, but as a matter of fairness, deterrence, whatever, we should impose, you know, if it's a case where the person was negligent, may well have caused it, but nobody can prove or disprove whether they caused it, the fair thing to do is impose proportional liability, right? Now, if they can prove they didn't cause it, they're off the hook. And that's true in the DES cases. If you can prove you didn't cause it, you're off the hook. But I think that that's a possible valid use for it, but not by claiming we can prove something we can't prove. Thank you.